Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. From the Mississippi to the Colorado and beyond, America's landscape is traversed by more than 3 million miles of rivers. We have shaped those rivers, building dams, levees, making them deeper and wider. And the rivers have shaped us, our country's history, our culture, and our idea of water as a resource. This hour on Point, America's history through America's rivers. You can join us on air or online. Do you live along one of America's rivers or canals? How have you seen them change over the years? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from Durham, North Carolina, is Martin Doyle, professor of river science and director of the Water Policy Program at Duke University, author of the new book, The Source, How Rivers Made America and America Remade Its Rivers. You can find an excerpt of his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Martin, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
You're a river scientist, a river engineer. So tell me what brought you to look at America's history through its rivers.
I had been poking around rivers for science and for different management projects, and every time we would be brought into one or I would be working on one, there was always the random questions of, well, why are we doing this? And that would lead to, well, the Corps of Engineers wants to expand this. Well, why is the Corps of Engineers doing that? Well, because of this other reason. As we kept kind of backtracking through these various projects, it starts to raise these other questions of, well, why do we have an agency like the Corps of Engineers and the Department of Defense that's in charge of the waterways and the rivers in America? And those questions just kind of plagued me for long enough to actually start spending my evenings and weekends starting to dig through some things that led to what you got.
You write that America's waterways are at the heart of our basic identity. You say that even our constitutional convention owes something to rivers. How so?
Yeah. So back when after the Revolutionary War, George Washington was very interested in starting a canal company. And so he was trying to get one along the Potomac River. And one of the catches with that was that he had to get Maryland and Virginia to agree on something. And this was under the Articles of Confederation. And so it wasn't necessary for states to agree on much of anything. And so Washington called a convention first at his house and then later at Annapolis, where he was trying to figure out how to allow interstate commerce to happen on waterways that two different states shared. And they couldn't resolve this at the Annapolis Convention, and so they started a conversation about a larger convention that they would take place in Philadelphia. And that's what led to really the Constitutional Convention, which started with Washington trying to figure out how to get interstate commerce for his own idea of a canal company. And that's how it all got started.
So our history is deeply ingrained in these rivers. Yeah.
Indeed, indeed.
So the Great Depression was a period of great change for America's rivers. You write about that as well. In what way?
Really, everything started to pivot. I mean, there are a couple things. The first Great Depression that we had in 1837 was in large part also due to rivers. The states themselves were investing heavily in canal companies, and those canal companies went bankrupt, and they took the state budgets down with them. And so about 100 years later, we had the Great Depression for in the 1930s for other reasons. And one of the big things that that we did as a nation was invest in a lot of infrastructure as a way of kind of bolstering the national economy, as well as getting a lot of these jobs back on back into society. And there's a lot of things that we point to. So the Tennessee Valley Authority is probably one of the quintessential things. FDR called it the jewel of his crown, of his progressive era crown. But we also did a lot of dam building for the Bureau of Reclamation out west. A lot of the levees built along the Mississippi River as well. So during that era when we were building things, it just turns out that building dams and levees and wastewater treatments as well is a very good way to absorb labor. And that's what we spent a lot of our labor dollars on in the Great Depression.
How would you say over the generations Americans have shifted their views about our rivers and our waterways and really how we use them?
We aren't aware of them nearly as much as we probably used to be. I think in a lot of ways we drive over them. We might notice a little sign that says something about George Washington or FDR or something like that on the side of the road. But we tend to be very separated from rivers. So just general awareness. I think a big thing is we're not aware of the central role that rivers play in our modern economy, whether it's through hydropower and stabilizing the grid, whether it's through irrigation out west, or probably more than anything else that's overlooked is the central role that barge traffic plays in moving heavy commodities around our nation and around our world. And so we tend to forget the fact that our economy is based on these currently, and we also tend to forget the fact that a lot of our regional economies were started by doing something with rivers. Mm.
You write about those big barges to which you just referred when you took your trip along the mighty Mississippi River with all of its levee systems and flood controls. Tell us about that trip, about that towboat trip on the Mississippi.
It was definitely probably the highlight of my career. It's one of those random things. One of the things that I did discover writing this book is that people who work on and around rivers are inordinately fascinated with them, and they're also very quick to help other people understand them. And so this was one of those moments where I just randomly said, I wonder what it'd be like to ride on a barge and to see the river from the river out rather than looking down at it. Called a barge company and floated the idea by them. And to my shock and possibly horror, they said I could tag along. So off we went.
So how has the Mississippi River changed, would you say, then, since, you know, I mean, such a famous river, such a famous mark in our country. In 1883, Mark Twain called it the crookedest river in the world. Has it changed over time and evolved?
It has. So in a lot of ways, I mean, number one, we control the hydrology to a spectacular degree. For one of the planet's largest waterways, rivers, we're able to, the Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, and all of the other agencies involved are able to control the hydrology to a degree so that we don't get floods that devastate the entire Deep South or the Midwest like we used to. There's still the possibility of these, but they've done a marvelous job on that. In addition, the river, for better or worse, it's a lot straighter than it used to be. It's a lot easier to get these quarter mile long barge tows up and down the river, and it just makes moving things around that much easier. And then from down on the boat itself, if you imagine kind of Darth Vader's lair with all of his technology that we might see in movies, that's what the river looks like from the viewpoint of these boat captains. Is all the technology makes a lot of things possible that were not otherwise. So instead of having people dropping lead weights on strings to try to figure out how deep the river is, we've got this three-dimensional picture of the river as these boat captains go up and down it.
There is such interesting history in this book, from the mighty Mississippi to the Erie Canal. You write about that as how it helped facilitate trade and commerce between the North Atlantic coast and the burgeoning West. You know, you talk in your book about the things that our kids learn in school, from federalism to sovereignty and property rights, and you say that all of those things can be looked at through the lens of our rivers and what we've done to our rivers. Explain that to us.
Yeah, I think probably the best example of that is when I started to tour around the levee districts of the Deep South, and this was after the flood of the early 2000s. And when I started to go up there, I imagined that I would stand on top of a levee with somebody from the Corps of Engineers, and they would explain things to me. And instead, I called the Corps, and they said, well, you actually need to go and talk to this guy, Peter, who runs a levee district. And I was kind of dumbfounded by that. And so I went and met Peter, and one of the most knowledgeable people on the planet about levees and geotechnical engineering and these things. And he works for this thing called a levee district. And it's a subdivision of government that manages levees. That's its function. It's very similar to a school board. The board is created to manage the school. The levee district is created to manage levees. It's a subdivision of government. So the federal government does some things that only the federal government can do, and levee districts does things that it can do very locally and with its very deep knowledge of flooding in that way. And so that's just one of the many examples where, in order to understand this little quirk of a river or this little thing that got built on a river, I had to backtrack all the way and actually dig out my old ratty copy of the Federalist Papers and say, now, how did we actually get here?
That's great. Let me get Jim in here from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I live very close to the Missouri River, and on the other side of the river is Council Bluffs, Iowa, where Lewis and Clark had a council with Native Americans.
Oh, yeah.
And when I look at the Missouri River, I think of how I think about that voyage of Lewis and Clark up the river and how important that was to the opening up of the American West.
Mm. Really formative. Jim, thank you so much. A formative moment, Martin Doyle, in American history for sure.
It is. I mean, as Jim would know, the idea that these two guys had, along with the group that they brought with them, to go up the Missouri River when they did is just shocking to me. I worked on the Missouri River. My brother is also a river scientist, and he works on the Missouri River. And when we go out there and just you realize the staggering achievement that they did, and this made sense at the time. If you were going to get around a landscape as big as the Louisiana Purchase, you were going to do it by boat. And so they had to understand the Missouri River to actually make sense of what they had just bought back in the early 19th century.
Hmm. Jim, thanks so much for the call. Martin Doyle, you're not the first to look at history through the lens of water, but it's certainly an interesting take. I think about Wallace Stegner, among others, who've mm-hmm. done the same. What is your hope, your takeaway? What do you want people to know about rivers from your work?
Good question. So I think probably the thing is that when they drive over river, if they stop in Council Bluffs, that people who aren't from Council Bluffs, that they actually take a look at it and think about how did this river actually shape the city that I live in and where I live, and the fact that I actually am in a federalist government.
We are talking about America's rivers and America's history this hour with Martin Doyle, author of the new book, The Source. You can join us. What's the history of the river near you? Do we still rely on our rivers as we once did for power, for transportation, for commerce? Here's Mississippi River Blues by Big Bill Brunzi. As we go out, I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
And hard to love someone when they are so far from you. Lord, I'm gonna get me a boat and pass this old river through. I went down to the landing to see if any boats were there, and the ferryman told me could not find a boat nowhere.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
You've probably heard about this Russia investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Every day there's a new headline about it. Well, Embedded is back with two episodes that lay the whole thing out, start to finish, so the news makes sense. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. That is sound from YouTube of the Missouri River rushing along. We're looking this hour at the might and mythology of America's rivers, and you can join the conversation. Do we manage rivers, or do they ultimately still manage us? Is Mother Nature still in charge, or are we with our dams and our levees? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. From Durham, North Carolina, Martin Doyle is with me, professor of river science and director of the Water Policy Program at Duke University. His new book is The Source, How Rivers Made America and America Remade Its Rivers. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And joining me now from Los Lunas, New Mexico, is Sandra Postel. She's director and founder of the Global Water Policy Project. She was a freshwater fellow at the National Geographic Society, where she co-created Change the Course, a freshwater conservation campaign. She is author of Replenish, The Virtuous Cycle of Water and Prosperity. Sandra, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. You've been working on global water issues for a long time. When you look at America, what do you see as the most critical water issue before us, especially when it comes to America's rivers?
Well, I think, you know, the critical issue now is one of balance. You know, how do we balance our use of rivers for all the things Martin's been talking about, you know, for shipping, for hydropower, for irrigation, for water supply, with the important functions that rivers play as the basis of life, you know, and the ecosystem benefits that we get from healthy rivers. You know, for a long time, we didn't have to worry about that because rivers were plentiful, you know, as we discovered and explored and settled the West. We didn't have to worry too much about it, but now we've really sort of begun to overtap those rivers, and, you know, their health is at risk. We see rivers running dry. We see groundwater being depleted, which, of course, supports river flows. And so I think it's one of finding balance. How do we have, you know, healthy economies, healthy agriculture, and healthy rivers at the same time?
So the issue of balance is really important. And you've said that dams and the depletion of groundwater and industrial agriculture, all of that has seriously broken the water cycle. Tell me about that. What do you mean?
Well, the water cycle is, in a way, you know, this planet Earth's greatest gift. You know, we wouldn't be here without it. And so I think when we look at the components of the water cycle, so the watershed from which our drinking water comes and the rivers that carry water through the landscape, the groundwater that we turn to as a critical reserve in times of drought, the soil that holds 8 times as much water as all rivers combined, each of those components is not working very well. We've sort of, you know, broken them in various ways. And so it's really looking at, and my book is very optimistic. It basically is a very solutions-oriented book that talks about how we can fix this. And it points to examples in the real world that shows how we can do this. And again, I have, you know, I'm a very optimistic person about this, and I think we've done a tremendous job in meeting our needs for water. You know, the engineering is just extraordinary that's gone into making water so available for farmers, for cities. But now it's a question of, as I say, balance. How do we get some water back to nature, use it smarter, become more efficient? And there's still a lot of ground to be, you know, to be won in that area.
So to the point of human need for water, I was stunned actually to read how much water the average American uses every day. Help us understand how much we're actually using.
Yeah, so most of us, you know, think of water only when we turn on the tap. You know, we turn on the tap and water comes out. And that itself is a feat of engineering, that we don't have to worry about it. But really, our use of water, what we would call our water footprint on a daily basis, is much bigger than what we get out of the tap at home. So everything that we use, wear, buy, eat, takes water to make. And sometimes an extraordinarily large amount. You know, it's surprising. A simple cotton T-shirt can take, you know, as much as 700 gallons, most of that to grow the cotton out in the field. So if you look at your daily life and walk through it, what you eat, what you're wearing, the energy that you use, and, of course, the water that you use at home, both to water your garden as well as to drink and cook and take a shower with, it adds up on average. If you're an average American, it adds up to about 2,000 gallons a day.
A day.
And so a day, 2,000 gallons a day. Most of that, about half for most people, is in your diet. It just takes a lot of water to grow crops, whether you're growing them efficiently or not. It takes a lot of water. Those crops have to transpire water to grow and photosynthesize. And so a lot of our water footprint is tied up in food. Energy is about a third. Every time you fill up your car with gasoline, every gallon of gas takes about 13 gallons of water to make.
And so, Martin Doyle, jump in here. Human consumption of water, what has been most surprising to you in the context of your research and a look at America's rivers?
Well, I think I would echo what Sandra has said. Is I think both of us are optimists about this. I think the reality is setting in that there's got to be some adjustments on things. And I think that what I have been most surprised about has been this dramatic pivot that's been happening. One of the most surprising things to me is how many startup technology firms there are just in water and the technology behind water, whether it's sensors or big data companies or new membrane kinds of companies for treating water, that there's a very big, what we might call a blue revolution going on of trying to figure out ways to get at this problem through technology right now. Now, that's not going to solve everything, but it's definitely the fact that there's so much market activity and market interest in water really, I think, echoes what Sandra is saying as well.
Let me segue here to the Clean Water Act of 1972, because Martin Doyle, you link its passage to the burning of the Cuyahoga River in Ohio, which famously caught fire in 1969. Here's a clip from the 1967 film The Crooked River Dies, describing how badly polluted the river was.
The waters of the Crooked River are legally dead. 35 treatment plants have added their effluent to the stream. Much of that discharge has been classed as inadequately treated. Industries have used and reused the declining waters until the quality is so bad that industries downstream must clean the water before they can put it to their own uses.
Martin Doyle, gross and really negligent pollution of that industrial waterway in the Cuyahoga really gave rise to movements to river conservation, to restoration, and many other things, no?
Yeah, well, there's an interesting backstory on this. Just like a lot of river history, there's some meandering that's going on behind it. The reality is that the Cuyahoga River had burned multiple times. I mean, dozens of times that we could find records for in the early 20th century. And in fact, the infamous picture of the burning of the river that led to a lot of the Clean Water Act getting so much attention, that was a picture that was actually taken decades before because they didn't have a picture at the time. The river was put out so fast. That particular burning actually got so much attention because when Time magazine publicized the burning of the Cuyahoga River, it was in the same issue of the astronauts returning from the moon and Ted Kennedy and the Chappaquiddick disaster. Mm. So there was actually this kind of nuance to it. But when people flipped through that issue of Time magazine, they suddenly saw this picture of a river burning, and it really drove home the appalling state that a lot of rivers were in. And one of the big things that I dig into the book was I found this woman, Edith Chase, who was one of the unspoken heroes behind saving the Cuyahoga River.
An Ohio housewife, right?
Exactly. Yeah, this Ohio housewife who really pushed through a lot of the things behind the Clean Water Act. Mm.
Let's get John in here from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, John. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I live on the banks of the Connecticut River in Hanover, New Hampshire, and we moved here in 1973, I think it was. And when we moved here, the river was a sewer, basically. Mm-hmm. Even this far north, it was a sewer because every town above us was dumping their sewage and the plants were dumping their effluent, and it was just horrible. Mm. I mean, we were told not to even put our toe in the water.
Mm. Is it the same today?
I'm sorry?
Is it the same today? How does it look now?
No, ma'am. It is absolutely, completely different. The Clean Water Act has cleaned it up to the extent that it is now a Class B river, which means you can fish and swim and boat and do all kinds of things in the river. It's an absolutely beautiful place.
Well, John, thank you. Martin Doyle, is the Connecticut River an example of how the Clean Water Act really transformed our rivers?
I think it's a great example. I mean, I've been to that exact place that he's talking about, and it really is a spectacular nook and cranny of New England. I think one of the key things to note about the Clean Water Act was not only did it introduce these regulations about how pollution had to be treated before it went in, but it came with an enormous backstop of federal funding to actually enable cities to pay for that treatment. And I think that that's one thing that's overlooked is the 1970s, early 1980s were a period of environmental regulations being tested and tried and adjusted as they went along. But all of those came along with a lot of money behind them for the infrastructure that was going to be necessary to do the work of the Clean Water Act.
Mm. John, thanks so much for the call up there in Hanover. Jim is in Mauston, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
My mother lives on the Mississippi River between Lansing and La Crosse and Dubuque, and it's on one of the sharpest bends in the entire river. And what's really interesting about it, there's a bridge that connects Wisconsin with Iowa there. And it's very interesting to watch the barges trying to negotiate that bridge. Mm. At one time, there were two coming up. One was coming up and one was going down. And they got so close to each other, it probably took about 3 hours to negotiate past each other. They were probably within 6 or 8 feet of each other. And it is one of the most beautiful spots, I think, on the Mississippi. There's islands all over the place and a lot of recreation there. National Geographic took a picture there a few years ago, and they named it, I believe, one of the 50 most beautiful spots on the Mississippi.
Oh, Jim, you're painting a beautiful picture for us. Thanks very much for that call. Let's go to Kathleen in Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm here in Dayton, Ohio, where I grew up taking care of my 89-year-old mother. I haven't lived here in 45 years. But, you know, when I've become far more fascinated with the river system where here in Dayton, you know, the Stillwater River joins the Miami River just north of downtown, and then the Mad River joins, and it all creates the Great Miami River. And when I grew up here, of course, you know, it was a lot of manufacturing and industry during the 60s and 70s, and the rivers were quite polluted. But I've become really fascinated with how, you know, the Native Americans, the Adena and the Hopewell and the Miami, the Shawnee, how they all had used the river systems, and then how it was used during the American Revolution and settlers, and then in the manufacturing industrial era. And of course, now what I see happening here, because of it's so sad, all the job loss here in Dayton in the manufacturing and that industry is pretty much gone.
Yeah.
But now the metro parks, the Dayton City, through the metro parks, are doing an amazing job encouraging birding and kayaking and canoeing and putting it to the best uses at this point in time. So I've just become fascinated with the river system here in Dayton, Ohio, far more so than when I was growing up here.
That's a great image and a great call. Kathleen, thank you very much from Dayton, Ohio. Sandra Postel, jump back in here. I mean, you've written that managing our water is a central function of civilization. You say history is littered with impressive cultures that didn't get it right. Does that apply to modern day America?
Well, I think it applies to, you know, to all civilization. You know, water is the foundation of it all. And, you know, one of the early civilizations in North America that was stunning in its application and use of water, you know, was the Hohokam in the Southwest. And They basically settled around what we would call now the Phoenix area, where the Salt and the Gila come together, and, you know, basically established a very advanced civilization that lasted 1,000 years in the greater what is now the greater Phoenix area. Literally, if you were able to roll up Phoenix like a rug, you would see the remains of the Hohokam civilization. And then a sequence of things happened, but drought factoring in an important way in it, it seems, from what archaeologists have found, you know, that led to the demise of that civilization. The people left that area, spread around, and as a culture, as a distinct culture, they basically were done. Mm. But they had gotten it right for a long time, and then somehow couldn't negotiate that you know, series of events that happened. It was floods, it was droughts, but, you know, we're beginning to see those kinds of things in our own time, and particularly with the changes in the water cycle that will happen with climate change coming on, we need to really be alert to that and not be too sanguine about this. I mean, we have at this moment, you know, a situation in Cape Town, South Africa, where a city of 4 million people is looking at having to turn off the taps to 4 million people because the reservoirs are too low. I think the latest date is May 11. They may have to shut off those taps. Well, that's a wake-up call for us. That's a very, very serious situation we have not seen in modern times, where a big city is having to basically shut down its taps and ask people to go to one of a couple hundred distribution centers to pick up, you know, a few gallons of water per person per day to get by. So it's an important wake-up that the past is no longer going to be a good guide for the future.
Martin Doyle, that Cape Town issue is a real problem. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago here, the changes in the water cycle and how global warming is impacting all that. Sandra speaks to it very well. What do you say?
I completely agree. I mean, one of the big voices in climate change right now is farmers in the Pacific Northwest who have they've been noticing that they're no longer getting they're getting the same amount of precipitation, but they're getting it as rain or sleety rain rather than snow. And that means that a lot of that rain is or a lot of that precipitation is going down the rivers in winter and early spring rather than going down in the summer when they actually need to divert it. So I think everybody is kind of right. People who are in tune with actual precipitation patterns have been noticing the changes for the past couple of decades, and it's just a very big reality check that's going to very gradually creep up on us, and hopefully we won't be boiled like a frog, but we'll actually start thinking about how to address those changes more proactively.
You say you're optimistic. We have about 30 seconds. Do you think we're getting it right generally in America when it comes to our water?
Not yet, but I think we have some of the right people in place who can help us through it.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking this hour about America's rivers, their majesty, their history, and how we're changing them. You can join the conversation. Who do you think has a right to use the water in our rivers? How do we prioritize that? What do you think needs to change about the way we use our rivers, our water? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Martin Doyle is with me, professor of river science at Duke University and author of The Source, How Rivers Made America and America Remade Its Rivers. And Sandra Postel, director of the Global Water Policy Project and author of Replenish, The Virtuous Cycle of Water and Prosperity. Less than a year ago, California declared an end to a five-year drought, but lack of winter precipitation is bringing new worries. Here's that report from CBS in Los Angeles.
1 year after California was hit with record rain, the state is quickly plunging back into drought.
The U.S. Drought Monitor says severe drought conditions now exist in Los Angeles, Ventura, and Santa Barbara counties.
It's not just California, Martin Doyle. 11 western states plus Texas are abnormally dry or experiencing some level of drought. How do you view those conditions, these droughts, in the context of your research and the water supply?
Well, if we've learned anything from dendrochronologists, so people who study tree rings and they reconstruct these things, what we're learning is that these kinds of droughts are not that unusual, that the early 20th century when we really started to get our infrastructure built and we thought we understood regions like the Colorado River, it turns out that that era of time was an abnormally wet period. And so what we're starting to see now is probably a more realistic view of what the climate is like in the western U.S. And then when we see things like Hurricane Harvey, where there were 50 inches of rain during that 48 to 72 hour period, I think that's the kind of thing that's a bit shocking of, is that normal? Is that climate change? And to a certain degree, it doesn't matter. We got it, and now we have to figure out a way to deal with it.
Here's a clip from Good Morning America on ABC, their coverage of Hurricane Harvey and the devastating impact on Houston, Texas, in August of last year.
Houses just about submerged. We have never seen anything like this before.
It is just incredible, all the video and images that are coming in. And of course, Harvey is still wreaking havoc on the fourth largest city in America. And as we have been saying, it is far from over.
Much more rain to come. There have been more than 2,000 rescues in the Houston area.
Let's get Art in here from Drakesboro, Kentucky. Hi, Art. Welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Jane, Martin. I grew up on a farm. It had a small creek running through it that didn't go from its source area very far to a river. And I noticed as I was growing up that the more they drained the source area of our small creek, the more the water fluctuations changed. It became a creek that instead of flowing constantly, even through drought, now it has water, a lot of water in it, or it has no water in it. And I was just, that seems to have disrupted the ecosystem of a pretty good little stretch of creek there. And I was wondering how we're thinking about that. I'd like to take my answer off the air.
We're glad you called, Art. Thank you. Martin Doyle, what do you say?
Great question. One of the things that I do like about rivers is all the different accents in America that you get to hear when you work on rivers. But in Kentucky, you live in a karstic area, so you've got a lot of limestone underneath, which means that your groundwater and surface water are really tightly coupled. So any change that they would have in the area of pumping groundwater would end up causing big changes in the small creeks and streams that you see. Like Sandra was saying earlier, the groundwater is the source of most streams. And so in a place like Kentucky, where you have these limestone aquifers underneath, as soon as the pumping starts happening, you're going to start to see the signature of that in the streams and creeks up on top of the landscape. Mm.
All right, thanks so much for the call. Let's get Michael in here in Centerville, Ohio. Hi, Michael. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I noticed your last caller mentioned a small stream. Being a farmer in Ohio, I have a little creek that comes from the corner of my property. And I'm concerned, my observation is a circle of water. It's fine to talk about the Ohio, the Missouri, the Mississippi. They all need to be discussed, but where do they get their water? Now, my little creek goes to Little Sugar Creek, goes to the Little Miami, goes to the Ohio, goes to the Mississippi. And there's thousands and thousands of these little streams that feed these great waterways.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to see that. It's part of a big circle. Eventually, the water that runs off my farm ends up in the Gulf of Mexico, goes up into a cloud, and comes back down on my little farm.
Michael, thank you. It is a great image, actually. Sandra Postel, is that how you view it, a big circle of water, as Michael says?
Well, I think Michael makes a very excellent point that everything is connected when it comes to water. And so protecting those, you know, those creeks and those streams that feed into our larger waters is very important. And so, you know, the clean water rule that's now, you know, under discussion and debate, I think it's a teachable thing for us to realize that we need to protect those headwater creeks and tributaries and streams, because the quality of the water and the supply of water downstream depends on that. So it's an excellent time to, you know, for that question and to really, you know, have that conversation, because our current administration is thinking about, you know, diminishing our protection of those tributary creeks and streams.
Michael, thank you very much for that good call. Jeff is in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Yes, I would just like to give a perspective of the Mississippi River.
Okay.
At a point called Brady's Bluff in Tremplo, Wisconsin, in Perot State Park.
Mm-hmm.
You can get up to the top of the bluff and you realize that the river is just a big, you know, scar in the face of the earth from thousands of years of water coursing through.
Mm.
And it's an awesome reality, you know, scene when you actually, you know, think of it that way.
Jeff, thank you. That big crust of the earth, a big sort of, what did he use the word he used, Martin? It just sort of a big gouge
scar,
in the earth,
a
scar.
Was,
yeah. Yeah, it's cool. Jeff, thanks. Here's Michael in Athens, Georgia. Hi, Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Jane. This is a question for Martin. We have a lot of issues in the state of Georgia with what we call rites of passage. And, of course, as a paddler, we always tell everybody, if you don't use it, you lose it, which means, you know, people are going to restrict the use of the river.
Right.
And my real question is, how can the states restrict the right of passage when the federal law says that you can have the right of passage?
Oh, I'm not going to wade in too deeply into this one here, but I think the right of passage, as Sandra was mentioning earlier, this water, the waters of the U.S. rule, is something else that has come out. It turns out that a lot of the way that we interpret both the U.S. Constitution and the way that we interpret state law, especially with issues related to property rights, have their roots in rivers, and whether or not we can divert water off of those rivers. How different states compete for rivers, like they're in Georgia, between Georgia, Alabama, and Florida, is a big case that's been brewing for many years. And then this issue of passage, about whether you can actually move across someone's property on water in a boat without ever touching the ground, and whether or not that's legal. And some of these things seem like small arcane questions until you're confronted with these kinds of issues about, well, what can I actually do on my land if I happen to have a small swampy wetland or happen to have a small creek like the caller from Ohio did? Can I actually do that without asking for permission from the state or from the federal government? Mm-hmm. And these are just layers of complexity, legal complexity, that have their roots in our in the rivers of our landscape.
Michael, thank you very much for the call. About a minute left here. Sandra Postel, what do you think needs to change about the way we use our rivers? How do we need to prioritize our water use?
Well, one of the really optimistic points that I found in my research and tried to write about in my book Replenish is the importance of collaboration now. That, you know, I think we have left a lot of the decision making to the experts, you know, to the engineers, and that has been very much to the good in many, many ways. But now, as we see these, the need to balance these priorities, you know, recreation, fishing, birding, that require healthy rivers, along with the more traditional uses of water, you know, hydropower, irrigation, mm-hmm. water supply, I think we need to bring more people into the conversation. So many of the examples that I talk about and stories I talk about in my book are really ones of interesting partnerships, interesting mm-hmm. collaborations, where you have ranchers and farmers and conservationists and local irrigation districts and local and state governments working together to find these interesting solutions. Mm. And so I think it's really democratizing water and bringing more people in.
Sandra, that's great. Martin Doyle, would you agree this sort of collaboration as we think about the future of our water and our water sources?
I couldn't agree more, and I think the only thing I'd layer on top of that is I think that the government, whether federal, state, or local, really needs to decide on what we actually want. Do we actually want to have dams and levees? And if we do, how much are we willing to pay for it? And are actually willing to put our money where our mouth is with these things that we want out of rivers?
What do you want us to remember from this conversation about rivers, Martin Doyle, and your research on them?
I just want everybody to look at them with a bit of a different lens and go down and actually get in a canoe and get on your local river and try to figure out why your city is located where it's at with respect to rivers.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation about a really important topic. Martin Doyle, Director of the Water Policy Program at Duke, thank you so much for your time today.
Good to be with you.
Sandra Postel, Director and Founder of the Global Water Policy Project, really appreciate your time. Thank you, Sandra.
Thanks, Shane.
In a moment, we'll look at the giant water tunnel that California is trying to build to bring water to its southern half. This is On Point. California has long needed a water fix. The drought-stricken state can't keep up with water demands. Governor Jerry Brown's ambitious water delivery project, tunnels that would bring water from the California Delta southward, was recently scaled back by billions of dollars. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Bettina Boxell, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, covering water and the environment. Bettina, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Hello, Jane.
So why does Governor Brown want to build these this tunnel?
This is actually a proposal that has been around for, in some form, for decades, and in its current modified form for about 10 years. And it would change the way, partially change the way water is delivered from Northern California to central, to the San Joaquin Valley into Southern California. So that water has been, you know, transported for decades, but it is used the big delta, which mm-hmm. is east of San Francisco. It's called the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, which is the confluence of the two longest rivers in California. It is used, that delta, as sort of the hub of the water system, and the shipments go through that delta. And that has contributed to a continuing ecological decline in the delta. And so the tunnel is, it was two tunnels, and now it's going down to one tunnel. Was a way of trying to stem the ecological decline and also to ease environmental regulations or restrictions that have limited exports south. Mm. But that transport of water, from Northern California to Southern California has been going on for decades and is indeed what, basically propelled the growth of Southern California in the latter part of the 20th century.
I have parents in Northern California, so I'm very familiar with all this and heard a lot about it. This project that's been downsized instead of a $17 billion two-tunnel project, now we've got one tunnel at $10 billion, but even one tunnel, this is a massive construction job with a tunnel taller than, what, a three-story building, Bettina?
Yes. I mean, it would be about 40 feet in diameter and would be 35 miles long and would be about 150 feet below ground. So, yes, it is remains a massive project. And it is still really unclear whether or not it is going to be built. And the primary question remains the financing of it, because it's supposed to be paid for by the water districts, largely public agencies, and irrigation districts that use the water that will be transported through that tunnel. And only some of those districts have decided that it is worth their while to pay for it, and that's why it's been downscaled from two tunnels to one tunnel, because basically the financing wasn't there for two tunnels. But it's still there's still many permits that it requires, and the financing still isn't, completely set in place. I don't think they have yet gotten commitments for even $10.6 billion. So water projects in California are always a very long, complex issue, and so the future of this project is still unsettled.
Here's California Governor Jerry Brown during his State of the State speech, speaking about his water fix project.
Finally, we have the California Water Fix, a long-studied and carefully designed project to modernize our broken water system. I'm convinced that it will conserve water, protect the fish and the habitat in the Delta, and ensure the delivery of badly needed water to the millions of people who depend on California's aqueducts.
Bettina, there's the governor saying this will protect the fish and the habitat. Of course, we know this is far from a done deal, but critics say, no, it won't protect the fish. It will do anything but that.
Well, there are... it will help in some ways with one species of imperiled fish, the Delta smelt, which is really near extinction, because it will take more water from the North Delta and less water from the South Delta, and those taking water from the South Delta with these two huge government pumping operations that fill the aqueducts has contributed enormously to the decline of native species. Now, the argument is that is all you're going to be doing is creating more environmental problems in the North Delta with these huge diversions that aren't occurring. So there are, arguments on both sides. Most environmentalists, have serious questions about the two tunnels and about the one tunnel, concerned that it is going to take more water out of the Delta, and concerned that it is simply going to move one set of environmental problems to another part of the Delta, and that will hurt migrating salmon.
Well, we will keep watching. Lots to look at here. Bettina Boxall, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, covering water and the environment. Well, thank you, listeners, for your input today. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Frankenstein rises again 200 years on. We'll see you then. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.